Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
Welcome to Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm Chris Jones, filling in today for John DeLynn, and I'm honored to be a part of this podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Kate Kelly, founder of MormonMayday.org. Kate, welcome to Mormon Stories.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
First off, give us kind of a quick introduction of what your website's about and what you're doing with it.
Okay. The website, like you said, it's MormonMayday.org. And it started sort of with an idea that, you know, there's a lot of things that have been happening, I guess political things in the United States that also have to do with the church. There's a poll that recently came out, a Gallup poll done of all the different major religious traditions. And of that poll, Mormons were, you know, surprise, surprise, Mormons who identified themselves as very conservative, were one of the largest of any of the major faith traditions in that category. And Mormons who identified them or self-identified as very liberal were less than 1%, which is also one of the fewest for any of the major faith traditions. Your readers, or sorry, your listeners may or may not have heard of Glenn Beck, a famous entertainer, who has recently made some comments about social justice. And basically he told anyone who could find the word social justice on their church's website, they should immediately leave that church. Which a lot of what he says is just, you know, hyperbole and pretty pretty circus-esque, I would say. You know, just basically for attention. And he makes a lot of money, so it makes sense why he says the things that he says. But I think that got a lot of people thinking about, you know, what does social justice have to do with faith? And additionally to that, the Senate Majority Leader currently in the United States Senate is Harry Reid, who is Mormon. He converted to Mormonism, and he was scheduled to give a fireside in his home state of Nevada. And he basically, at the last minute, they had to cancel the fireside because of threats that they received from Mormon people, from members of the congregation, from members there. So they, because of safety concerns, they had to cancel the fireside, which was a faith fireside. It was about his conversion story. And, you know, it really just sort of highlighted and enunciated the conservative bent of Mormon congregants. And so we kind of had this idea, why don't we start a website, and why don't we have a day where people who believe in social justice and people who have left-leaning politics and policies and beliefs, why don't they get together wherever they are and, you know, just begin to talk and converse and also commit to speak out in church. So that was a long explanation, I guess.
Well, you covered a lot of major points that we've seen, you know, from the Gallup poll to Harry Reid to Glenn Beck, that are all kind of a big part of this. But you know, going back to your, I guess, decision to step up, why now? I mean, why not, you know, after the Proposition 8 campaign, which was also a very prominent thing involving the church and, you know, conservative politics?
Yeah, I actually lived in California during the elections of 2008. I was living in San Diego, and that was a really difficult experience for a lot of members. And it was a difficult experience for me and my husband. I mean, I could probably do several hours of interview about Proposition 8, but suffice it to say that it was very difficult and I felt very stifled, not only to speak out against Proposition 8, which wasn't even necessarily my agenda, although in the end I did vote against it, it just to ask questions and to do legitimate inquiry into what the legal ramifications are. I mean, if you're talking about a political issue and a ballot initiative, I think valid questions to ask are, you know, what is the legality of this? What implications will it have? And those are questions I didn't feel comfortable asking. Yeah. And pretty much I stayed silent during Proposition 8, although I was solicited during church for donations, for time, to put up signs. It was mentioned over the pulpit many, 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 like innumerable times. I actually thought about starting a tally during Proposition 8 campaign about how many times it was mentioned over the pulpit, but it would have been like, you know, futile because it was in the hundreds.
What is that experience like, though, when you are politically liberal, you're an active member of the church, and the church officially comes out not only in support of the measure, but, like you said, you're being solicited and encouraged to participate. It seems to me that is one of the reasons, perhaps, that it is so much easier for a member of the church to side on with the Republicans or with conservative causes when there's such an effort.
Yeah, I think that, I think one of the things that, you asked the question, why now? Why are we finally coming out? Or why do we think 2010 is a good year to sort of galvanize the troops? But I think that, you know, a lot of people make the argument, church should be neutral. Church should be politically neutral. There should be no politics involved in church. And on one conceptual level, I agree. But I also think that it is impossible. I think it's impossible to completely divorce ideology from your religious beliefs, at least for me. And a lot of the political beliefs I have are because of doctrine, you know, that I believe in and because of the way that I interpret the scriptures. But also, the Proposition 8 campaign really hit home to me and a lot of people like me that the church is not divorced from politics. And to say that the church should be this place that is completely apolitical is to say that something should exist that doesn't exist. It is a political it's a political organization, for better or for worse. People in it espouse, proclaim, discuss political views, and those are often the majority views. Those are often, I would say, views from the far right. And those are, you know, even if people think, they shouldn't be talking about that, or, you know, say with sort of a grin, like, during the 2008 election, someone said over the pulpit, I'm not going to say who we should vote for, but we all know his surname begins with an M.
You mentioned Harry Reid. Mitt Romney is arguably the most prominent Mormon politician in terms of, you know, people in the church that recognize him and probably agree with him. But you mentioned Harry Reid, who is one of the most powerful politicians in the U.S. He's a Democrat. He's very active Mormon. And I remember a couple of years ago he gave a forum at BYU where he said, essentially, I'm a Democrat because of my faith, not in spite of it. And it sounds like you kind of agree with that your theological views, the way you read and interpret Scripture, informs how you engage politically.
Indeed, and I don't get me wrong, I'm actually not a Democrat. I don't identify with either of the major political parties here in the United States. However, I think that Harry Reid is in my ward right now. And he's a really interesting, engaged member of the church who within our congregation is very accepted. And since I live in Washington, D.C., you know, we have people like on both sides and all points of the spectrum. I mean, we have people who work at the Heritage Foundation. We have people who work for, you know, all these different organizations. We've got Harry Reid. We've got a little bit of everything. And it is actually, to me, a great example of how people can get along in a religious setting, despite these extreme divergent views. However, even in my congregation, people will feel free to say things in lessons. For example, the first Sunday we were there, we had someone quote from a Glenn Beck book in Sunday school, which by anyone's standard is not a gospel source. And the person giving the lesson said that if she could communicate anything to the leaders of the world, it would be that global warming is a hoax. And she went in, I would say, about 20 minutes of why global warming was a hoax.
Decidedly not not something you'd find in the Gospels or
right. In your Book of Mormon. Even though I was extremely uncomfortable, and I could tell, like, even, like, whispered to some people around me, and everyone was saying, like, this is really inappropriate and shocking, no one said anything. I mean, I can't begrudge them because I didn't say anything either. But the climate is such that if you disagree with something that's so, you know, in such discord with even what the gospel principles are, what the lesson should be about, I feel like we really don't have a voice to say that. And it's multifaceted. It's a fear of confrontation. It is what it is. But I really think that people who have a voice on the, or people on the left, don't have a voice within the church. And that's for a lot of reasons, but I am not a shy person, in general. But at church, I feel very quiet. I feel very, I feel silenced. I feel, that, you know, sometimes I do try to speak out, and the reaction that I get from other people, is not a positive one. It's not a welcoming, environment where, you know, I think the reaction I usually get is, oh, well, we shouldn't be talking about politics, but that's not, it's a double standard. That's not the same standard for people saying things that reflect the values of, say, the Republican Party.
How do these things, these examples, these conversations, how does that impact your experience at church functions every Sunday when you're, you know, in Sunday school or in other, you know, interactions you have within, you know, your ward community?
It depends on the congregation. I've been in a lot of congregations as a student. You know, I've moved around a lot and been exposed to several different congregations. And it really varies from area to area. It varies on sort of the median age of the ward. But I would say in general, if I were to make a sweeping statement, not about any particular ward, but in general, it affects me really negatively. I'm married, and my husband and I share, I would say, what most people would consider to be far left, political views. And we feel isolated. We feel like at least we have each other to cling to and talk about things after. And we can say, what about this? What about this? And we have each other, which is really a blessing. And I think a way that we maintain activity in the church. But hearing so many overtly politicized messages at church, it's not just me. I mean, it's depressing. It makes you feel unwelcome. It makes you feel like, what's the point of going to church if what I'm going to get is, you know, feedback about really, you know, things I don't believe in, things that I don't believe in, and maybe that I don't believe should be discussed at church. Or if they are discussed, like, I should feel free to say what I want to say as well. I know a lot of people have left the church, and that's another thing that was addressed in the Gallup poll, is that people who are, I think they called it lax Mormons, or Mormons, you know, we would call it inactive.
Right.
We would call it inactive. So most of the inactive Mormons self-identified as liberal. So I think that says a lot. It says that people like me and people who are on the left side of the spectrum don't feel welcome and don't feel like their contribution is valued.
Do you think it's a case where, you know, these so-called lapsed Mormons, the term that the Gallup poll used, are leaving because they don't fit in, because of their ideology, or do you think it comes the other way around, they leave and then they, you know, find liberalism, or maybe a combination?
Well, we didn't get into my political transformation, but I have not always been a radical political thinker. I used to be a Republican. In fact, I voted for George Bush in 2000. And I sort of had my political coming of age while at BYU when I realized, wait a minute, none of these values reflect what I sincerely believe and feel. And I sort of, you know, gradually migrated out of the Republican Party. But I remember as a Republican back in my good old conservative days, I remember saying to people, I distinctly remember saying to a particular friend of mine, how can you be a Democrat and a member of the church? I had heard that before from other people. I wasn't saying anything new that no one had said before. I'm ashamed that I said it now. But I think that that type of attitude is open and voiced in the church. And I myself have said it to people. When I self-identified as a Republican, I claimed that those people had no place in the church. And that's not just something that you feel, it's something that people say. So I think that personally, because I now am very active politically, I worked on several campaigns, I'm very active on the political left, I feel that I know a lot of people who are politically active and liberal, and it's not like they, you know, decide the church isn't true and then become a Democrat. I feel that, you know, my reading of LDS doctrine and theology, like Harry Reid said, could easily lead someone to being, you know, I would say even far left, more far left of the Democrats, but certainly on the left side of the political spectrum. And I don't think it's like people are disgruntled and disaffected and then decide to join up with another political party. I think that either interpretation is equally valid. And I think that people, I know for a fact that many of my friends who have left the church just cannot stand the contradiction that it places upon them. I mean, when I tell people, you know, when people learn a little bit more about my politics and they also find out that I am a practicing active Mormon, they are shocked. They're shocked. They say, you know, isn't that sort of a contradiction? don't you sometimes feel a contradiction? And I say, no, I don't sometimes feel a contradiction. My life is a contradiction. I embody contradiction. I feel it every day. I feel it every Sunday. I feel it all the time.
I know a hero of sorts for moderates, liberals, progressives within the church is Marlon Jensen, who gave a pretty lengthy interview a number of years ago with the Salt Lake Tribune about his politics and about the state of civility and civic duty within the church. And he addressed that as well. He said that, you know, there's this notion you can't be a Democrat or you can't be a liberal because and be a good Mormon. But he said no matter what party you're in, there's going to be a little give and take with different, you know, points of a platform or whatever, and basically said, you know, I'm proof you can do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think the general authorities don't usually come out and say which party they belong to, but I think that's a general problem with political parties in the United States, and maybe that's a larger discussion, but, you know, the two-party system is not in the Constitution, the United States Constitution. It is not enshrined in any document. It is not an official policy. There are not two parties in the United States of America, despite what many people believe. And I think that that's the problem when you have this false dichotomy of two parties. You can often, you know, it's often portrayed that, oh, how could you be, you know, X because they believe X, Y, and Z. Well, you know, for example, I think that Marlon Jensen mentioned this, that, you know, when it was becoming a hot issue, the Republican Party was considering having a much more flexible stance on abortion or even adopting, you know, a pro-choice standpoint. You know, now it's such a thing that totally drives people to either side, and it's such a hot issue that's debated in the United States. But at the time, you know, if you take back a larger historical perspective, these two parties haven't always been what they will always be, and those issues, to me, the things like abortion and gay rights, and you know, these things that people that sort of create the polemics of the two major parties in the United States. To me, those just aren't the make it or break it issues at all. I feel like those are issues that they've used to sort of, you know, rally a frenzy, you know, and sort of drive people into this really false dichotomy. But to me, I think that abortion is an important issue, but nothing more. It isn't the most important issue. And, you know, so certainly I understand why it's an important issue to people, but it's also important to consider all the other very important things that can happen politically. And to me, it's just not a make it or break it. Yeah. I also feel that, you know, kind of how you're saying, you know, it is possible. Look at me, you know, he said. But I feel like people on the left have these like few isolated examples that they can kind of pick out and say, you know, like, look at Jensen. He is a Democrat. You know, look at Harry Reid. He is a Democrat. And I think we can kind of sort of cherry pick these different things that make us feel better. But I think that's sort of the idea of Mormon May Day, is to make our voices heard wherever we are, and to sort of galvanize not only, you know, solidarity with other people, but within ourselves, to say what I have to say is legitimate. What I have to say is of value. What I have to say is part of my testimony. And I'm going to share that. You know what I mean? I'm going to have confidence in who I am. And I think that's something that's really lacking.
Now, with the Mormon May Day, May Day is cry for help. Is that right?
Yeah. We sort of how we have it on the website is if May Day, obviously, May 1st is International Worker Celebration around the world. It's not actually celebrated as much in the U.S., but in other countries, for example, in the U.K. and France and really all around the world, they have huge celebrations and parades, thousands of people celebrating worker solidarity. And then additionally, May Day repeated three times is a radio distress call. So it's kind of like an SOS when you say May Day, May Day, May Day.
So your May Day, your cry for help in solidarity. And so far, it looks like you have three events. Is that right? D.C., New Haven, Connecticut, and Nashville?
Yeah. It's been a really great experience, even just now, because we've been getting a lot of emails from people just saying, you know, basically, thank you so much for doing this. I just appreciate to know that there are other people out there. I'm really excited. So we have a bunch of people. There's probably going to be an event in Michigan. There's going to be one in Provo. We're trying to get the word out as much as we can with the short notice. But the main priority isn't necessarily to plan, you know, some huge event or, you know, make it really complicated. To me, the idea is, you know, get together with other people if you can. even better, you know, to feel supported and to feel just, you know, camaraderie with people that think like you and, you know, have views of the gospel like you have. But also to me, one major component of Mormon May Day is we want to join in a fast with everyone who hears about the website or who signs up on the website or who hears about our cause. We want to join in a fast with everyone to further the cause of social justice. And then if people feel prompted to bear a sincere testimony about what they've been fasting for, so that others can know and so that they can assert their voice. So yeah, so far there's 3 events up on the website, and we hope that there will be more.
Do you feel like, I'm assuming this is kind of the beginning, not obviously the end of your efforts in this?
Oh, definitely. I think, you know, we're the people who are organizing Mormon May Day right now. We're all students, and we are, as everyone is, very busy with our lives and our causes and our work. But we want this to be the first year of Mormon May Day, and we want it to continue and, you know, become sort of more of a community and an event, an annual event for people to celebrate, but also as a vehicle to let people know that there are other people like them, but also to help people have the courage and resources to reach out to people where they are and let them know how they feel. I feel like one thing that we really want to emphasize is this is not combative. You know, it's really frustrating to feel alone. It's really frustrating to feel like a message you totally disagree with is openly expressed on a regular basis in your religious worship services. But this isn't, the idea of Mormon May Day isn't to say, okay, you know, we've got a far right, like overtly far right political bent in the church, and now we're going to arm wrestle it back over to the left in a confrontational way. No, definitely that's not the idea. The idea is to feel comfortable in a peaceful way to assert our views and to, you know, contribute to the discussion and to share who we are. I feel like a lot of liberal Mormons are sort of incognito, you know,
yeah.
On Sunday. People, you know, you know, you might not say even what you do or, you know, what you believe. Sometimes I sort of couch things that I do in, you know, different language. For example, last year I campaigned for Ralph Nader, or not last year, in the 2008 elections, my husband and I were the campaign coordinators in San Diego for Ralph Nader, and we were doing tons of stuff. I mean, we were working really hard, but I don't think I ever discussed it at church. I, you know, with the whole Proposition 8 fury and fervor, I just didn't feel like there was a place to tell people, even though it was a huge part of my life. I didn't say anything. Even when people were basically debating candidates in class, I just didn't feel like I had a voice to get up and say, you know, actually, I am campaigning for this candidate, and that this is why, you know.
Yeah.
So I feel like a lot of times we are really incognito, you know, as any minority group in any dominant culture is. And I feel like this is sort of a way for us to say who we are and what we believe.
You mentioned a couple things a couple minutes ago. You know, abortion, same-sex marriage, those are pretty hot issues and polarizing issues and have been for a long time. And I think for people that grow up now, you know, in the church culture that is overwhelmingly conservative, it's easy to assume that's always been the case, but you know, Lyndon Johnson carried Utah in 64, and Utah, along with a lot of Western states, were part of the New Deal coalition in the 30s and 40s. So there has been shifts. I don't know if that's something that you've thought about within the church, how ideology has shifted, and if that's something that gives you hope that, you know, a shift could happen again.
Yeah, I think that's just going back to taking a more historical perspective. You know, I think that politics right now, I mean, the only apt analogy that I can think of is what I mentioned before, which is a circus, where, you know, these clowns in the media sort of get up and shout things on either side and, you know, do these crazy antics to get people to sort of bunch into these two groups or to, you know, come over to their side or to rally people into a frenzy. And that's the myopic view, you know, right now, like in the past years, in the past decades. But when you take take a step back and look at the larger historical context, not even within the church, but within political parties in the United States, there have been a lot of changes. And particularly with Utah, you know, Utah wasn't always a completely solidly Republican bloc. And I think that, you know, these hot button issues, like you said, that are really polarizing have helped to galvanize not only Mormons, but, evangelical Christians and, a lot of different, very religious Christians, sort of too solidly in the Republican side. But I think anyone who's done a historical analysis that's definitely not a prognosis of how politics in the United States will be forever. And I certainly am one who hopes that it is not. But that's not only within the church. I mean, I certainly, when I look at the scriptures and when I, you know, when I look at the principles of the gospel and of, you know, the history of the church, I can find so much evidence of cooperativism, for example. Cooperativism, you know, some people, socialism has become this really also demonifying word that Glenn Beck has used as sort of a slur against the left. But when you think about what Zion means, that Zion means that there will be no poor among us, and how that is achieved and how that happens, that also means that there will be no rich. To have rich means that they have more than someone else. When you think about these principles and when you really apply them to me, you know, almost every scripture in the Book of Mormon, or many of them, talk about, you know, warn us against materialism, essentially. When you really think about how those play out in politics, and how those play out in our society, I certainly hope that there is a shift, and I just don't see any other way. But as far as the church goes, I think that's completely possible. I think that there's a new generation, and I think that the new generation will have new issues, to worry about. I think that same-sex marriage, you know, and right now it's extremely divisive, but in 10, 20 years, it will be completely resolved. Whatever the outcome is going to be, it will be resolved. And, we will have new issues, new challenges, and hopefully that will bring new ways of thinking, new ways to think about things. I don't know what the outcome will be and what the effect will be, but I think that any group who feels completely silenced, whether it's people telling them not to speak out or whether it's because of their own fears, is not going to be able to influence the dialogue. And so that's definitely a goal, to be able to speak out and to, you know, challenge other people to think, you know, about the questions that we think about.
I'm curious, Kate, going back a ways, you mentioned that your political transformation happened while you were at BYU, and I think it's probably safe to say that Provo is among the most conservative cities in the country. What was it that led you to kind of reevaluate your political philosophy?
Well, I was socialized to be a Republican, as many Mormons are. My parents actually converted to Mormonism, but I grew up in the church. They were both Republicans. My grandfather was a Republican state senator. At home, we had elephant mugs on our, you know, a mug from each election year, representing the Republican Party. I just didn't know, I guess it's simplistic to say, but I just didn't, know that there was any other option. At BYU, you know, you gravitate towards certain people, you explore certain ideas. I served a mission for the church in Barcelona, Spain. And actually, it was on my mission where I think that I really began to talk to people who I never had talked to before. I began to meet people, and that was one of the most brilliant, wonderful experiences I had on my mission, is you're able to reach out to people that you never would have been able to reach out to before. In Spain, there's a huge immigrant population who lives largely undocumented, and those were many of the people we taught, and we were able to see how they lived and the difficult, you know, just alarmingly difficult circumstances in which they found themselves. And I think that was really when I started thinking about how other people live and how political decisions affect them when I was in Spain. There's also a lot of racism in Spain within the church and without outside of the church, but definitely certainly within the church, because there's a large part of each ward is made up of Central and South Americans who have immigrated to Spain, and sort of how I saw that dynamic play out with the linguistic and cultural barriers that there were. And so really it was on my mission, ironically, that I started converting myself to a different political ideology. And I loved my mission. I enjoyed, you know, I know people say this, but I enjoyed it thoroughly. I enjoyed every day of my mission, although it was really, really hard and difficult. And there were certain things about it, I mean, that could be a discussion for another day, but I enjoyed my mission. And when I came home, I sort of started thinking about things differently and, you know, being really attracted to friends and groups of people who had different ideas. And, you know, I listened to certain music and would sort of think about different ideas. And I just remember one day a friend of mine at BYU, I was listening to some folk music of an artist named Dar Williams, and he said, "You listen to Dar Williams? You can't be a Republican." And I, you know, I just started laughing, but at the time I thought, you know, maybe I'm not a Republican, you know? Like, why do I think that I'm a Republican? And I also had a professor at BYU. I was actually taking a I did political science as an undergrad, and I was taking a politics and religion course at BYU, you know, and it was a small seminar class. And I said, oh, you know, it was kind of after like the end of the semester. And I said, oh, and I just don't know why we all feel like we have to be Republicans, blah, 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 blah. And he stopped the class, put his hand on the table and said, "Wait a minute, you're a Republican?" He's like, "I thought of all students that I have, like, you would not be a Republican." And I, you know, I started thinking, okay, well, I didn't have an explanation. In class, I just said, "I don't know, I've just been socialized to be a Republican. Maybe I'm not." And so, you know, after all these experiences I had been having, I sort of just started thinking, like, what is it to me? Like, what are the issues that are important to me? What is it that, you know, which party or which candidates or who are the people who address the issues that I think are the most important and who have the most compassion? Because after my mission, I felt like compassion was extremely important and essential to any political dialogue, and I did not find that within the Republican Party. And so that's actually the great thing about BYU, or one of the great things about BYU, is because there's, you know, whatever it is, 35,000, 40,000 students who are all, for all intents and purposes, who are all Mormon, and you're going to find a handful of people who you really identify with. And I found a great group of friends, and including my husband, who's now my husband, that really, you know, questioned things. And, you know, we even planned a protest at BYU that we're really afraid about. And I was threatened that I would be kicked out of BYU. It was my senior year. And one of my professors said, you better have a backup plan. You better start applying to other schools, because there's a chance that you will be kicked out of this university. And he was very serious. And, you know, we did the protest, and it was very successful, and we found more people, you know. So we were able to build sort of a community of people that thought like we did, even at Brigham Young.
It sounds like really this this experience on your mission and this notion of Zion, the no poor among us, really kind of gestated and really influenced you.
Yeah, it certainly did. When I was on my mission in Spain, we were teaching people who were living in closets. We were teaching people who couldn't meet with us because, for all intents and purposes, they were slaves. They were house, you know, domestic workers who their bosses wouldn't let them leave, refused to let them make phone calls, made all sorts of unreasonable demands. And that was because they were undocumented, because they were exploited because of this legal status that they lacked. And it really started making me think about what that means and why certain people have power over other people. And it affected their lives. It affected their ability to learn about the gospel. And that was, to me at the time, the most important thing, was to be able to share the message of the Book of Mormon and to share the gospel with people. And that completely ability to consider spirituality. And I think that that's when I started thinking about, I mean, it sounds so simplistic, but I was, I grew up in a middle-class family. I had everything that I really ever wanted. I just didn't know that that wasn't the case for everyone. Or I didn't think about it. I mean, many people do, but I was not an enlightened teenager, I guess. and I hadn't really considered it, and hadn't met people, who were so, so different than me. Until my mission, and it was really eye-opening, and it was wonderful.
Oh, you have on your website, MormonMayDay.org, a lot of resources from quotes and scriptures to articles, and one of them, I wanted to read a little excerpt from BYU sociology professor Richard Johnson. 16 years ago, he said this, and you mentioned your middle-class upbringing as kind of the spark in my mind. He said, I do not anticipate much repenting being called for as the result of our political party affiliations or specific policy preferences. However, I can easily imagine a hereafter in repenting and pain experienced by contemporary middle and upper class active American Mormons is due to the sin of keeping too much for ourselves while so many others have so little. I believe it is the great unrecognized sin of our LDS subculture, myself included. It sounds like that's really up your alley in terms of where you sit relative to the rest of the church and in America.
Yeah. I found that article when I was at BYU, actually, when I was experiencing sort of my, for lack of a better word, my political awakening. And I was so impressed. I read that article and I was like, yes, I can't believe someone thinks this. I can't believe someone writes about this. I didn't know, like, you know, and he was a BYU professor, and I was really energized and excited about the message in his paper, which I think anyone should read, because really it's not, he's not talking about political parties at all. He is talking about sin, the sin, as he said, of keeping too much for ourselves. And I contacted him, actually. I sought him out. I was so excited, and I just loved what he had to say. I sought him out. I contacted him. I asked him if he would come speak to a group of students about his paper, and he actually was very sad about what had happened to him, and I don't want to speak for him, but what he told me was that he had received so much pushback for publishing that article and for writing that article, and, you know, so much pushback that he basically had promised his wife that he wouldn't speak about it any longer, and he would take no public speaking engagements about what he had written. And that was pretty much the end of our conversation, and it was such a letdown to me. It was so devastating that I had found this, you know, this professor that had believed, like, so many of the things that I had been thinking about, and I was so impressed, and then for him to say, you know, basically that almost ruined my life and I can't talk about it anymore, was so, it was bad. It was awful. And I felt bad for him, but I also felt bad for me and people like me who wanted to speak out, because, you know, that could be a lesson for us of what would happen to us, you know, if we were to take the same path. So I absolutely love everything he has to say in that article, and he's very meticulous in using scriptures to demonstrate that it's just, you know, basically the parable of the widow's mite is not about how much you have to give, it's about how much you keep for yourself, and that the widow who gave everything is very emblematic of how we are to live our lives. And I definitely think that, and I'm by no means the perfect example of that in any way, but I certainly think that is what is expected of us.
Does that make you discouraged as you try to take a more active role when someone like that is essentially stifled, you know, with what you're doing? Do you feel, is this worth it? Is this going to make a difference? Or are you hopeful that it will?
It's certainly discouraging to me, even just because if that happened to one person, you know, if that happened to him, or, you know, I know of a lot of other people who have tried to speak out on, you know, particular issues or particular things who have received harassment, basically, so much harassment, that they haven't been able to continue. And it, in some ways, that's, to me, it is discouraging, but in some ways it's also encouraging to me to know that it's so important that we do speak out. It's encouraging to me because there's such a need. If someone like him or other people that I've known do not feel like their voices matter, or that they can speak out on things that they feel is important, there's a problem. And so I feel really excited and energized to galvanize people to create a space within Mormon culture and within our religion, where people can say these things, and where people, and, you know, specifically with him, it was a very sincere religious belief, that he felt, you know, was of paramount importance to our salvation. People should be able to say things like that. And so for me, I feel, you know, simultaneously discouraged and encouraged because I know that it is so important. And, you know, an experience like that just makes you feel lonely. It makes, you know, people who have written us emails about Mormon May Day, or, you know, starting to plan events, or have tried to reach out, I would say a common theme with everyone is that they feel lonely. When you're not part of the dominant political or cultural paradigm, it's a very solitary experience. It makes you feel alone. It makes you feel isolated. And I don't think that anyone should have to feel like that. And so, to me, it makes the mission even more imperative that we reach out to people and let them know that what they have to say is valuable, and not only valuable, it's important. It's important that they share.
All right. Well, Kate, best of luck. Site is MormonMayday.org, an effort to help moderates, liberals, and progressives feel more at home within the LDS culture. Kate, thanks for joining Mormon Stories.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at MormonStories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.